Well, we're facing a pivotal moment in human history. The United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change recently released a report that says humans must take massive action to stave off the consequences of a warming planet. The report says that we as a planet must keep that temperature from rising beyond 1.5 degrees Celsius, or there will be grave consequences. NPR recently spoke with Christy Eby, a co-author of the report, and here's what she said about what some of those consequences are.
There are places where it will become more difficult to grow our crops. It'll become too hot and too dry. There's places in the world that are already water stressed, and that water stress will increase quite a bit with additional warming. Heat waves, we've seen quite a few heat waves in the U.S. and around the world this year. People die in heat waves. As the temperatures go up, those heat waves become more extreme and more frequent. And unless we take action, then the projections suggest more people will die in heat waves.
Well, in South Florida, we're dealing with increased flooding during king tide, saltwater intrusion to our freshwater supplies, and more problems. How does the report provide a look into our future? Well, today we're going to discuss that and, of course, how climate science is playing a role in this election season. And, well, there's just a plethora of things to discuss. And we're talking with Yoka Arditi Rocha. She's the new executive director of the nonprofit, the Clio Institute. Yoka, it's such a pleasure to have you. Thank you.
Thank you, Luis. It's such a pleasure to be here.
And by the way, the Clio Institute is hosting their annual leadership summit tomorrow evening, which is open to the public but requires tickets. So we'll have information up on social media. I'm also joined by environmental and transportation reporter here at WLRN, Kate Stein, who, by the way, will co-moderate this conversation with me today. WLRN will be hosting a Sea Level Rise Town Hall event tonight in Wynwood, which is free and open to the public. Kate, great to have you.
Thanks, Lewis. Happy Climate Week.
It's true. I can always count on her to keep me up to date with what's going on. Yoka, let's start with this. I mean, this recent report comes out. It says, quote, that unprecedented action is needed to keep global warming from passing the catastrophic threshold in the next few decades. What stood out for you in that report?
I think the level of urgency. It was the kind of like the last call of the scientific community around the world calling for swift decarbonization of our economy to maintain temperatures under the 1.5 threshold. That kind of urgency really struck the most. I mean, we've been listening to these reports for many years now, but the IPCC report was very clear that urgent action is needed now.
There was a part of this that jumped out for me, and it was this part. It said, there is no documented historic precedent for the sweeping change to energy, transportation, and other systems that are required to keep us in that under that 1.5 Celsius. How does that statement make you feel? Maybe am I reading into it? It just says, we don't know if it's possible.
You know what? I like to focus on, I know that the report really brought a lot of nervousness and people really started to getting really worried. And I like to focus, instead of the doom and gloom, I like to focus on the positive, that there are solutions available right now to reverse global warming. In fact, one of our most interested programs out there that we are so thankful to be able to present in South Florida tomorrow, which is our keynote speaker in our event, is the author of the Project Drawdown, which is the most comprehensive plan ever proposed to reverse global warming. So the solutions are there. They have identified more than 80 solutions to reverse global warming and draw down greenhouse gas emissions from the atmosphere.
You're optimistic.
I am optimistic because they are available. Now we need to build three things. Three things need to happen for that. One is we need to build public support. We need to really focus on public awareness. People need to acknowledge that this is an existential threat, an unprecedented threat to humanity. Second, we need to be sending the economic signals, the market signals, for our economy to be able to decarbonize. And with that will come the technology changes, those solutions that are available. So I am optimistic about it. Now, that doesn't mean that the urgency is not there. We need to start acting now.
And one of the main things that the scientists talked about in that report from the Intergovernmental Panel was this idea of a carbon tax, which I think is something you were alluding to. This idea to put a price on pollution. And that's something that Congressman Carlos Curbelo has proposed, actually, in the state of Florida here. What are your thoughts on that? How could a carbon tax be an economic solution to the issue of global warming?
So it alludes to what I just said, that we need to be sending those market signals, those economic signals out there. And the policies have been lagging very, very far. And governance have been lagging with it, even though there are many countries around the world that are implementing either some sort of carbon dividend or some carbon tax.
And can you break down how that works exactly in the countries where some sort of carbon tax is rolled out? Who gets taxed? Who's paying?
Right. So there are many different market structures, I guess. There are many different types of programs that can be structured. What we need to start is with actually pricing carbon for what it's worth. So basically being able to account to price carbon so it takes in account the societal costs, of meaning all the cost that is costing cities that are dealing with flooding.
If carbon causes a certain amount of damage, there's a price tag on that damage, and then the tax is something to cover that price tag, basically.
Yes, but actually to represent the true cost. So we're not really, the reason why we're still in a fossil fuel-based economy is because really we're not really paying the true price of carbon. In other words, the government in the United States gives $20 billion in subsidies to the fossil fuel industry every single year, whereas just extreme weather events cost our economy $320 billion just last year. So we need to be taking in consideration those externalities. How much is it cost to public health? The pollution, how much is really costing that carbon pollution to society? Once we do that, then we can be really, other energy sources will be at an even playing field. Right now, subsidies for fossil fuel industry outweigh renewable clean energy 7-1.
All right, I want to come back to this. I know that you're optimistic, but if we don't meet that goal in the time frame that the UN report says, what could happen, especially here in South Florida? What do we see? Because we heard at the beginning, what we could see worldwide, increased droughts. You know, it'll be very difficult to grow food in many places. And then, of course, a lot more people will be, at risk for, heat-related illnesses, because heat waves will increase in intensity and in length. But what would we see here in Florida?
So in Florida, we're going to see a lot more of what we are already seeing today. So we have already, our climate, our temperatures have already increased about a centigrade, right? And we're already seeing effects on our sea levels rising. We are seeing the intensification of hurricanes and other extreme weather events. We're going to be seeing intensified drought. We're going to see increase in mosquito-borne illnesses. We're going to see all those really being exacerbating a lot more. So we're going to be dealing with sea level rise and tidal flooding nuisance in a more recurring basis, not just only during king tide.
Also read, too, that if it goes beyond that 2 degrees Celsius, that could be the end for coral reefs.
Correct.
The entire world, this is. Exactly. There would be no more coral reefs left in the entire world.
In the entire world. And we know that coral reefs are our number one first line of defense in the coast against storm surge. Let's not forget the actual natural ecosystem benefits of being the fish's nursery. So it is an unprecedented threat to our, livelihoods.
We're listening again to a conversation that we're having right now, actually, I should say, with WLRN environmental reporter Kate Stein. And we're talking about this recent report from the UN on global warming. And we're talking with Yoka Ardidi Rocha, the new executive director of the nonprofit Clio Institute. Kate had talked about, the carbon tax. That is on a federal level. All right. So, and we've talked about this, Kate. I'm just like, what about the local level?
Right.
Or is that something that, what can we do? What can local governments do beyond resiliency?
Correct. And I should point out that a tax can go in effect at a state level as well, just like California, who has a cap and trade system right now, which is an emissions trade scheme. So there are many things we can do at a local level or a federal level, but definitely a carbon tax will be at a federal level probably the most swift and urgent policy we can implement for a rapid decarbonization of our economy. At a local level, there are many things we could do. at a city level or a state level. We have one on the ballot right now coming up in November 6th that people should be rallying for, that will prevent more dependency on oil and gas.
This is the offshore drilling ban that's on the state of Florida ballot.
Correct. Yeah, exactly. Protecting our waters and protecting our tourism, our beaches, is number one for our economy and for our tourism, but also for our climate.
And so your organization is obviously doing a lot to try to educate people around climate change and what solutions can be in communities and for individuals on the local level. You've done things like offer workshops to city employees. Like I think in Fort Lauderdale, you train city employees there and some other communities. But you've also focused a lot of attention on teaching people in lower income neighborhoods like Liberty City here in Miami and Overtown and Little Haiti. Why has that been so much of your focus?
I think, well, as you know, the Clio Institute has been in South Florida for 9.5 years, really building climate literacy. And several years ago, our founder, science teacher, and recently recognized as Time Magazine as one of the most influential people in the South, Carolyn Lewis, realized that there was a stakeholder missing out of these conversations. We have been going to homeowners associations, faith-based organizations, businesses, municipalities, schools, universities. But we had identified that, you know, the ones that are suffer the most for climate change impacts are the most vulnerable. And for us to be resilient, we need to be focused on those vulnerable communities that may not have the safety net to prepare, you know, for more extreme weather events.
And that's something that we saw during Hurricane Michael just recently, where people who were in low-income housing or housing, affordable housing complexes, they were some of the people who couldn't pay to evacuate. They may not have had access to transportation or, you know, they had to stay, basically. They didn't have a way out. And as hurricanes intensify, those people are more and more vulnerable. What are some of the other impacts to other ways that climate change could hit low-income people in Florida particularly hard?
Well, Lewis mentioned heat. The heat extreme events are definitely something that a lot of low-income communities may suffer the most. As our planet gets warmer, we're going to be seeing heat, especially here down in South Florida, heat index days of 95 degree, and that is specifically very detrimental for the labor force and for the agriculture force here in South Florida. We know a lot of that. Our low-income housing do not have air conditioning units, so as our days get a lot warmer, that poses a tremendous health risk.
You know what? When you talk to folks in all of these different communities, but we talk about specifically, you know, the communities lower on the end of the socioeconomic pole, how do they react to conversations about climate science?
You know, it's been a wonderful experience of being able to come to these communities to talk about this, because I think, and this is why we focus so much on education, when you explain really complex terms and really complex science to people, and that's what we do at the Clio Institute, people connect the dots right away, and they start making sense of all this. We just finished a pilot that we implemented at Overtown that focuses on empowering resilient women, and we focus on women because women are disproportionately more vulnerable to climate change impacts around the world, but also they're the first responders in communities after a disaster strikes. They're the first one checking on their neighbors. They're the first one organizing food drives in their community. They're the first one, you know, they're the ones taking care of the elderly, the children, the ill. So we've been going to these communities and trying to empower them how to be more resilient, how to prepare better in the face of extreme weather events, not only physically, but also financially, how to get ready to buy supplies for in the face of a Category 4-3 hurricane.
And obviously other important stakeholders in this conversation about resilience and preparedness for the impacts of sea level rise and climate change in Florida are the people who have been elected and hold political office. What do you think, Yoka, about how climate science and sea level rise are being discussed this election season?
Well, I have to tell you that yesterday this debate was a first for us in Florida. We haven't seen climate and the environment take such a pivotal, central role in the political climate discussion.
This is the debate between Andrew Gillum and Ron DeSantis.
For the governor's race, correct. But it's also being, you know, the environment is at the top of major congressional races as well as the senatorial race as well. So the environment plays a huge role, and with that, climate as well. So we've seen the conversation being elevated in different levels at the political level.
And what did you think about, I mean, because you see the how different the two candidates are and the two parties are when they talk about the environment in Florida. They're not running away from environment, but you tend to hear one side talk about climate change, sea level rise. The other wants to focus on the Everglades restoration, and red tide. Mm-hmm. They're all interconnected, yes, but I mean, your take on really how both DeSantis and Gillum responded to issues of climate science.
Yeah, I'm going to have to refrain from talking about what Gillum and DeSantis talked about last night, because I was not, I did not listen to the entire debate. But I do, I can say this, that both they're politicians, and they speak to their particular base. I think the environment plays a huge role in every single Floridian. I think everybody should care about clean air and clean water. But unfortunately, the climate discussion has been politicized in our country. This is not a partisan issue. Now, a lot of people need to make those connections that you mentioned, the algal blooms, that algal blooms are really They're man-made cause pollution. They're the result of man-made cause pollution, not only because of the extra nutrients from the agricultural sector and also from leakage in septic tanks, but also it's being exacerbated because of warming waters. So it is another impact from climate change that we're seeing, where it exacerbates a problem that already existed. So we've always had hurricanes, but warming waters are making the hurricanes a lot more intense. So this, the same thing is with the algal blooms, both the red tide and the blue and green algae. So we are everything is interconnected, as you mentioned. But some one party tends to focus a lot on the perhaps added adaptation focus, whereas another one may focus a lot from the mitigation and what's the problem at the root.
And are there things you think that we can do to maybe make climate change something that's easier to talk about?
I think
less politicized.
Less politicized. You know what? And I'm going to be optimistic again here, Luis. So I'm going to say that if there's a place that I've seen that bipartisan gap close, it's here in South Florida. You mentioned Congressman Curbelo being one of the few has ever proposed a carbon tax in Congress, who openly talks about the issue.
Right, and he's a Republican.
And
we should
he is
know.
A Republican, exactly. So if there's a place that bipartisan gap is closing, it's here in Florida, specifically in South Florida, because Mother Nature has been sending clear signals. So it's impossible to really not pay attention to that.
Let me finish with this, or just real briefly. I mean, I'm going to come back to this. I know you say you're optimistic, but again, this report says it's a small window of many changes that we're going to have to make globally. It's not just here in South Florida, this country, but globally, to be able to keep us within that range that they gave us. And anything beyond that could be catastrophic. But you really believe, when you think about the politics in this country, and then you're talking about, you know, the growth in China and so many other areas, that we can.
I do believe we can, because there are solutions already available and they're being implemented. So they just need to be scaled up. But we need to build that political will, and that public support is tremendously needed. That's why we're such big fans of the Drawdown Project, and I would encourage your listeners to look into it as well.
Yoka Arditi Rocha is the new executive director of the nonprofit Clio Institute, and I've also been joined by WLRN environmental reporter Kate Stein. And Kate, you got a big event coming up tonight.
Yes, tonight WLRN is hosting a town hall on sea level rise. We're going to be hearing from local officials, also artists and scientists and others, what South Florida communities can do in response to sea level rise and some of the other climate change impacts we've talked about, like heat. You can watch a live stream on WLRN's Facebook page starting at 6 o'clock. That's, again, 6 o'clock tonight. Sea Level Rise Town Hall.
Yoka, thank you so much. Such a pleasure.
Thank you.
All right, we'll get you back in. Lots to talk about, I know.